Okay, so what I thought I would do is begin by, so we had a conversation like this a few weeks ago, and some of you were not here. One was led by Christian, and this is the summary slide of what he wrote on the blackboard that day. It was this was a discussion on critical observations, and he was advancing his multi-wavelength campaigns across various source classes. And this is barely legible, and I'm not going to try and read it, but I'll just remind you that it is on the wiki, and those of you who are observers might want to think about that, but I'd like to talk about that again today. But of course, me being me, I want to focus instead on the other discussion that we had, which was the day later, which I led on critical simulations. Again, I'm going to just review this briefly, but then I'm going to remove all this, and we're going to do it again. Because what I tried to do at that time, and again, I'm just saying this as a reminder, is telling you a little bit about what are the main things that drove the existence of this program. So one was the fact that there are these fantastic new observations in say protoplanetary disks from ALMA and Sphere, fantastic variability data in X-ray binaries, and dwarf novae, which have always been there, are now reaching a stage because of theory that we can actually do something real. So in particular on the simulation side, we've been doing for some years now, we as a community, I won't pretend that I'm a simulator like Yan Fei, have been doing radiation MHD simulations of MRI turbulence in these disks, both local and increasingly global. And once you do global radiation MHD simulations, you no longer really have an excuse to not directly connect with observations, right? You really don't. And so the mission for this program was to try and make that connection. Some of the questions that we raised at that time, is there a critical Reynolds number for MRI turbulence, to which Geoffroy Lesueur, I think, who was there, immediately said it's 1,000. And so it's probably not relevant for the quiescent state of dwarf novae. There were some issues about this. So the existing radiation MHD simulations are currently using gray frequency integrated equations. So there was an issue raised about whether, how do you handle Planck mean versus Rosslyn mean opacities in those gray equations? And also, should you be doing frequency-dependent radiative transfer? And maybe some of you have been thinking about that, but I know that Yan Fei, Neil, and I have been thinking about that, and Yan Fei hopefully has results that he will share with, not here, but with with us on that. Advection of large-scale colloidal magnetic fields. I know that some of you are very concerned about that. Well, and this goes across all sorts of different source classes. So those of you who have now drunk the Kool-Aid in believing that the MHD portion of a protoplanetary disk consists of large-scale magnetic fields and there's an MHD wind, and clearly Ilaria has drunk the Kool-Aid. That is, she is convinced by the theorist that that is actually what's going on. Have to believe that you can actually advect colloidal magnetic field in. And that idea is also now becoming popular, where's Greg and Phil, in the physics of X-ray binaries. And it may even be relevant to dwarf novae. But this is still an unsolved problem as to whether you can actually advect large-scale magnetic field inward in the accretion flow. Oh, convection and its effects on the MRI. Jean-Pierre still doesn't believe Matt and me and Shigenobu.
I co-signed the papers, I will believe it.
But this has got to be done in the global context. So what are people doing? I know we're aware that they're doing two temperature accretion flows where they're trying to treat the electron thermodynamics differently from the ion thermodynamics. That should be a capital M. AM CanVent simulations are now being done both locally and globally. So these are helium disks in very, very compact binary systems, and what's nice about them is that they're so compact you only have a factor of 10 in dynamic range, so you can really think about doing this globally. And they also show both normal and super outbursts, so we can probably get at this physics. But the more conservative among you would still like us to focus on hydrogen disks. You all know that Chuining, at least, maybe there are others, are doing global Hall MHD protoplanetary disks. And then we heard some talk during the program, at least from Chris Reynolds and his student Drew Hogg, but there are others working on this as well. CRISPR Gill and Bhupendra Mishra have been exploring this on the thin to thick disk transitions in X-ray binaries. So we also heard a nice talk by Alexandra on the physics of the hot accretion flow in the inner parts of X-ray binaries. But this transition and how it occurs as you're going around the Q diagram especially when you're going from soft to hard, and how you actually refill or replenish and recreate that hot inner flow is an outstanding problem. But I think this is within reach of simulations. And there's likely to be interesting hydrodynamics in this thin, maybe, in this thin to thick disk transition, because the thick disk, the hot flow is significantly more pressure supported than the thin Keplerian disk. And that, from what I've been hearing from you all in the protoplanetary disk community, that just looks, it's asking for some interesting hydrodynamics. Yes, that's what I meant from the soft to hard transition, right.
An example, that's why I was asking you, the protoplanetary disk.
Yes.
There's a gap.
Oh, yeah. Observationally, yes. Yeah. Yes. See, from photo evaporation.
Well, it depends on the data, but I'm not sure how to apply to the other item there that you have on the board.
This is photo evaporation.
Photo evaporation.
And since it happens in quiescence, in our system, it's unlikely to photo evaporation because there are no photons.
wait, there are plenty of photons in the soft state. The question is, can you, well...
In quiescence...
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be photo evaporation.
Dwarf Novi when the volume is truncation.
So I think.
Don't remember the dwarf Novi are the basis of
that. Of the basis of this program?
It was your idea.
I will get to dwarf Novi. Maybe we'll get to dwarf Novi. Okay, while we're on that note though, so one thing that does need to take, that if we're ever going to get at that, we do need to take into account global reprocessing of radiation, but that can be done with modern radiation MHD simulations. But the other thing is, if you believe Meyer-Hoffmeister, you have to introduce thermal conduction from the quote-unquote hot corona down to the disk if you're going to get it really do what they think might be going on.
Conduction.
Yeah, conduction.
Give me a little bit of radiation. If you stop all conduction, you can use.
Not if you have an ordered magnetic field in the corona, I think, maybe. So, that's very much TBD. Okay, so then the discussion ended by saying what we, these are what people are doing, the theorists are doing and pursuing. And of course, I haven't covered everything here. Many of you are doing other things as well. But what people should be doing, the observer said, is that we should be simulating nova-like variables, okay? So forget about dwarf novae, forget about all of that stuff. Just give me a disk that looks, that walks and quacks like a disk, okay? So just high accretion rate system, so you're way away from the hydrogen ionization instability, and it's all steady state, it sets up a steady state, and don't even bother about the stream feeding the disk. Make it axisymmetrically fed. Just give me a thin disk, okay, that's MRI turbulent, that has a radial temperature structure that you would expect from a steady-state thin disk, just from angular momentum and energy conservation, and show me that the variability properties of this turbulent flow, in terms of the flux that an observer would actually see, give you the correct RMS, give you the RMS flux relation, give you the log normal distribution, and give you a reasonable power spectral density. And can that be done? Yanfei?
Well, it depends on how thin you want to be.
But Athena++ with its mesh refinement can do that, right?
But the expense grows as a huge power of Athena++.
But forgive me, Sasha, you've been bragging about this massive GPU code that you've got that is going to just wipe us all out.
Yeah. We have no problem.
Okay. So I'm going to be looking at the two of you a lot in this presentation. I mean,
we don't have radiation yet.
No, so. You don't. So you need to be talking to him.
We should, yes.
We should have made a GPU version of Cinepal Plus.
You probably will have to eventually. But maybe not. I don't know. I mean, to tell you the truth, if the new Intel architecture is good enough, then maybe you... the CPUs will survive, but it would be nice to hear from you guys to see if those Intel chips are actually good for our types of code.
But you see, if we can't do a Nova-like variable, then we can't do AM condensed systems either. I mean, I'm sorry, we can't.
But I thought
do a nova left variable.
The hostate, right? The idea to hostate.
Yeah.
The disk may not be too thin, right?
Right, and well, it could be quite thin, but the simulation that you're running right now, if it ever achieves a steady state,
you're not that thin.
But but you could still ask the question in terms of the flux that's emerging. Does it give you these things, right?
Yes.
And yes, it's an AM-Kanven system, not a Nova-like variable. But there are quiescent AM-Kanven systems, I presume, that could be compared with. I don't know whether they have measured RMS flux relations and power spectral densities, but they are called stable. Okay, so just. You know, but of course you have other physics going on there, the stream in particular, which is doing all sorts of crazy things at the moment in the computer, which I can't talk about. But if you are interested, you should talk to Yan Fei and he can show you some movies. Chris Nixon in particular should talk to Yan Fei.
What physics do you think is essential to put into that, what I would call a vanilla flavored disk model? Do you need the full radiation hydro?
What you're really
looking for in terms of the variability is the ability of the underlying dynamo operating the disk to generate the time scales for you, please.
That's right. And so people have done proxies. We heard a talk by Chris Reynolds and Drew Hawk on exactly those proxies. But
you feel that you need to go.
I want to see photons. Yeah, I want to create, and we can create photons, right? And this is not that hard. I mean, it is being done now. And because we will always be asking the question whether the accretion rate at some radius or onto the central star is really an appropriate proxy for what an observer is seeing. And you can do more. I mean, you could do this as how is this changing as a function of photon? Well, we can't do that. That requires post-processing because this is still all gray. I was going to say, in terms of photon energy, but that can't be done yet, except through post-processing.
We'll have to do post-processing regardless, probably.
No, why?
I mean, you're asking all the, because you will want to compare the spectra, because the variability is...
Oh, sure, we'll do all that as well, and yes, so spectra, post-processing, that's the next thing, and then outflows. By the way, I want us to really talk about that today, especially in light of Ilaria's talk this morning, because we barely touched on that in the previous discussion. Yeah, but we don't have to do that. We can't. I mean, to get at those basic relationships in terms of the variability, and by the way, we have to get that right. We have to get the right T of R. If we're not getting, angular momentum and energy conservation, then let's just all go home, okay? So that has to be right. And I'm also predicting that, I mean, if they're all seeing through these proxies already that they're seeing these relationships, and by the way, let me remind you, for those who don't know, you even see these relationships just from a local shearing box simulation. You see an RMS flux relation. You see a log normal distribution in the flux from radiation MHD, local shearing box simulations, and that has nothing to do with propagating fluctuations. So these things are like sand pile models. They are universal systems, universal features of multiplicative processes that can occur in a variety of ways. So if we can't do that, but I would like to see it in photons. Wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But I also think you can get.
You could do it with a cooling function.
Well, you get part of the way there.
Yeah.
But it also would depend. I mean, in the observations, you only see certain part of the spectrum.
Right.
You don't see the energy, like the total energy.
Right.
But where you can get this wrong, you just see the.
Right. So.
So
another thing that could be done is to do this with some frequency dependent, but that is going to be even more expensive. But still, Christian Kaniga in particular just wanted to see this base. He's not going to believe anything that we do until he sees that.
It's got to be frequency dependent to match with the missions of the future. In fact, not to mention the data we already have.
Yeah, but that's coming. I mean, again, as computers are getting more and more powerful, it will have. I tell you, he's already done frequency-dependent radiative transfer in the last 24 hours, and just not in an MHD simulation.
But when he gets his hand on Sasha's GPUs.
Yeah, I know. They really have no more excuses, right?
I think it's true that focusing on these systems where the disk is really small is obviously the way to go if you want to really do things directly globally, right? I mean, it remains, to my mind, an open question of in those systems, how much you see is really transferable, right? Because
boundary layer.
Yeah.
Waves created there, maybe propagating through a significant fraction of the of the disk. The tidal effect from the companion maybe propagating into a significant fraction of the disk, and that may be quite a lot of what is seen.
So this is why, and we should think about this, this is why Christian and Jean-Pierre were both strongly advocating for the following. Throw away the companion star, okay, the tidal field, the stream, all of that. Just have an axisymmetric feeding. Throw away the central white dwarf. Instead, replace it with a black hole in the sense that it's just an inflow boundary condition, okay, no boundary layer, and just feed it axisymmetrically with some magnetic field and set up a stationary disk and do that.
Why is that not just a shearing box?
Because at least it's global. So the shearing box...
What are you actually getting from being global? Like, oh, it looks like a ring.
So the observers, I don't know whether you know about this propagating fluctuation idea. Do you? Yeah. Okay, that's what they want to see. That's what they think is universal. Even though you get that from a shearing box anyway. But that... So even though you could do that in a shearing box, if I just add a lot of independent shearing boxes together to make a global disk, once I start adding those fluctuations together, it's no longer a multiplicative process, but an additive process, and I will turn a log normal distribution into a Gaussian distribution. They want to see that the MRI really does behave like, you know, that there's some multiplicative process that is extending over the entire disk. It's a small thing. But at least it's the global disk.
Why do you want to have the expensive radiation to find that?
Because in my view, it's photons that we're observing.
But wouldn't you rather have a larger radial range?
But you could do that maybe, well, right. Yeah, right.
That would make you different whether you have a lengthening radiation or a condensation spectrum you see. With all density. But, I don't know.
You
also see one harmonic or two.
Yeah.
I guess the question I'm sort of trying to raise is, you know, there's a trade-off here between spatial
dynamic range and
physics and.
So let me remind you all that an AM Canvan system has a dynamic range of around 10. A dwarf nova has a dynamic range of 50 to 100. It's not that much larger. And again, both of those systems, even an AM Canvan system, those are observed. So that, you know, that dynamic range of 10, we could go all the way to an X-ray binary, in which case the dynamic range is much, much, much larger. But I still think that might be interesting. Or at least it was advocated strongly by a certain...
The question is much larger, but the ratio of the outer ranges to the inner ranges is much larger.
Right.
The disk itself is not, it is the ratio of the outer to the inner ratio.
No, right, that's what I meant by that statement. Yeah, right. Dynamic range is what I meant.
I saw it in complications saying, that
the disks and X-ray binaries are intrinsically larger.
For example, AGM, the accretion disks are much larger in cataclysmic variables. In fact, the ratio is exactly the same.
Okay, so something that I do think that we need to be thinking more of, and I know a few of you are, is post-processing simulation data to generate spectra. So maybe you don't need the full radiation MHD to start thinking about doing that. And then outflows. And outflows can be generated in a variety of ways, as we began to discuss this morning, and trying to get at that physics. So I want to remove this now, and I want to take us in a different direction, a new direction today. So how do I do this? I shut off the projector somehow.
And then the screen goes up over here.
Yeah, where's the... Is there a remote? And the screen goes up.
The screen switches the middle one on the
Button. The lights are nice. Can I call them white dwarf accretion disks? X-ray binaries, and yes, watch me. AGM. And you'll notice that I'll leave it to the last. Okay. So many of you, especially the many of the observers, I think, are source class specific, that you've been focusing on, because those are the systems that you're most interested in. And I'd like to start with protoplanetary disks. Half the community, I mean, part of the reason why we decided to bring these communities together is we thought that there would be a lot of crosstalk in the physics of these systems. And while I see, I just made eye contact with you, Chris. Another thing that we haven't talked enough about is deviations off the midplane, warping and twisting. So what are the important issues across the source classes and in that physical realm? We organizers thought that there would be some interesting crosstalk between these systems. In particular, I was hoping that the quiescent state of dwarf novae would have quite a lot to do with the non-ideal MHD effects that exist in protoplanetary disks. That is now looking less relevant a little bit. It looks like in the quiescent state of dwarf novae that you are sufficiently ionized, that ideal MHD is probably a good approximation. But on the other hand, I've learned so much about hydrodynamic instabilities that exist in accretion disks that they may be relevant to other source classes. Another thing I should remind you of before we get started, these are cold. These are warm, these are hot, and these are warm. So I think that this class is an extremely interesting thing to pursue with respect to understanding accretion physics. And I have to confess that, yeah, that might tell you a little bit about AGN, although AGN are much more radiation pressure dominated than any of these other source classes, at least when they're luminous. Okay. What should we be doing as a theorist? What do you want from us theorists, Ilaria?
Well, I would really like to see global simulations in which there is also, chemistry as well involved, so that I can compare the line profiles that I see with the theory. Yes. So I would like to see, first of all, a velocity field, and then some chemistry habits so that I could actually compare directly with the lines I see.
Chemistry can be post-processing?
Yes.
You just need temperature distribution, right?
Yes.
I think we probably expect chemical skills to be fairly fast.
This is actually being done to some extent already, by the way, is my understanding. So Schwenning, I know, has a very simplified chemical network that he's implementing. In his simulations, maybe you can comment.
Because I'm working with Uma Gorti, so I think that approach still could be further improved. So it has an approximation on the layer at which the FUV are absorbed, and my understanding is that it's not fully consistent.
I see. That's telling. By the way, this chemistry, this is non-equilibrium chemistry, which is why you really need a chemical network. Yeah. This is challenging.
I think you might want to explicitly put the non-LTE.
One reason you might want to do the chemistry in with the dynamics is that it affects the coupling of the magnetic fields to the gas. It affects where you can launch material onto the magnetic field lines.
This has to be done with MHD, right? An alpha disk description with hydro is not... And besides, we don't believe in alpha disk models anymore. We definitely don't believe in alpha disk models, especially after what you were showing this morning.
I don't know. What I see are these winds. I don't know if they drive accretion, but I see them.
Right.
So the next step from the observational point of view is to, I think, measure these mass loss rates and compare them with the mass accretion rate. And if we would see that they are similar, then I would think that it's the wind that is driving.
And when we say measure mass loss, so you already have estimates of mass loss rates in the outer disk, in the photoevaporative zone.
I can only say that it's higher than a certain value, but I cannot say the value.
Right. So how do you propose to do that? Or how does the community propose to do that?
So my approach is to use multiple lines, and by using line ratios of lines that have different critical densities, try to constrain the density and then also the temperature of the gas, so multi-wavelengths.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah. What lines are you interested in?
Okay.
What lines, so model?
We have forbidden lines from oxygen, ionized neon, ionized carbon.
Ionized carbon?
No, yes, we don't.
Neon 2 I saw this morning.
And also, we have argon 2 as well.
Argon 2, okay.
Yeah. Well, these are noble gases, there's no chemistry there.
With the oxygen.
But argon and...
In fact, those are actually my favorite because
of the So the neon 2, as I recall, is from the, from the outer, outer disk.
We think it's perfect.
This is coming from the inner disk.
Inner, and the one component could be outer.
Yeah. So Vlad, this is in particular why you would need chemistry if you're interested.
The old one.
Yeah.
And then we have CO, so that would be another interesting one.
CO, definitely.
Isotopologues, but that doesn't matter for the chemistry.
No, we have only the main isotopologue.
Oh, okay. So CO. Okay.
The community has been doing CO for some time, right?
Yep. Yes, but not in a very sophisticated way. I mean, often people patch together some plain parallel models, and I don't think that's good enough now.
Isn't it the case, one thing I learned that really fascinated me in this program is that no matter what you do, carbon monoxide is so tightly bound that basically all the carbon and all the oxygen will find, I mean, whatever you have will just find, they'll find each other and form carbon monoxide, and that's all the chemical network that you need.
That's
he says it being incredibly naive. And
well, in protocellates, people are starting to worry that it doesn't look like a sharp CO snow line. There's more of a gradual fall. People are starting to worry this carbons are being locked away in something as tar or gunk somewhere in the mid-plane. And so perhaps you have to worry about the carbon not being at interstellar abundance.
But the point is that CO is very easy to form, right? The molecule has no activation energy. So, and that takes us to my chemistry. But... how much chemistry go into simulating how that molecule forms?
So for the inner disk, I think there is no problem because the temperatures are very, very hot. But when you go in the outer disk, as Neil was mentioning, the problem is that if the carbon is sequestered onto the grains, then on the icy grain, you have more complex chemistry that locks the carbon in other complex molecules, and then it's not going up again to the surface, and so you will miss the carbon.
So you're worried about carbon or oxygen being locked in grains, basically.
The outer part of the disk. Yeah.
So the gas would have less CO than what you expect.
Yeah. Yeah. But not in the inner disk.
Not in the inner disk. Mm-hmm. So that's something for the coagulation model.
For the?
The coagulation model. What CO is locked in grains.
It's worth remembering, right, what the PUP 3 star formation people, right, they have been working for a decade on chemistry, and it's just hydrogen and helium.
Right.
And they're not doing, non-ideal MHD as well. It's a long way off to get global simulations with live non-LTE.
I would like to ask the question. How bad an approximation is it to do the chemistry post-processing, assuming equilibrium chemistry? Why do we need to go into all of the difficulty of including a substantial chemical network into a high-flow code to get neon 2, argon 2, and oxygen?
So for the neon, argon, and oxygen, since you don't need, and in fact that's what we are doing, right? We don't. But
and we're not going to be simulating the formation of tar or any complex organics sequestering towards the mid-plane. I mean, exactly right, where do we end up in this simulation?
So you would have thought that
the first thing to do is a radiation MHD simulation with a wind launching occurring within it, take some snapshots and then run that through chemistry and then look at the simulated emission from that.
And then, isn't that sort of the thing that Jake has been doing, Jake Simon, in his work with Meredith?
Yes.
Is basically, I mean, he's been working with Schering-Box simulations, mostly, not global simulations, but that...
Right, they're taking that turbulent flow and putting it into a model which includes an abundance of carbon monoxide, and then calculating the emission from that in the context of the disk model and looking to see whether or not it right. matches the observations. Here's slightly different, but actually, I mean, again, the chemistry seems to be relatively simple, actually.
And his objective is really to constrain turbulence. Whereas you're interested in the outflows, and that itself requires a global simulation. But still, your question is, I think, a good one. Do you really need to put everything into that global simulation to start making contact with what you're doing?
No, I agree with you. So I don't think you need everything to start. And in fact, but you should pick lines that do not require that type. So yeah, the noble gases are certainly something you would want to start with, perhaps also the oxygen.
But you do need densities and temperatures.
Yes.
And so you do need the full panoply of radiation magnetohydrodynamics. Again, my comment earlier on about do you need the radiation, I think this is one circumstance where you really need to have the self-consistently calculated temperature of the gas that you then use to do your chemistry and then to do your radiation transport on that to see whether or not the simulated lines that you get out of the calculation really match what you're getting from the observations, right?
So, for example, that might mean in your dynamical calculations the dust and gas have to have different temperatures if you're interested in the wind, because you want to go higher to where they thermally decouple.
Yeah, definitely. So, but that is happening already in many of the models, like the one that Moriarty has. So the two dust and gas temperatures are decoupled.
But that's not a MHD simulation.
No, that's correct. Yeah, that's the problem.
On that note, could I put in a plug? Because I gather, again, just from talking to you all, that this is a problem, that ALMA's circular polarization capabilities are less than desired. And I know a few people are thinking about Zeeman active molecules that might exist. And, you know, this whole program was supposed to be about MHD. is there any way that you all can constrain the presence of magnetic fields in any way, shape, or form in protoplanetary disks? Any way? Do you need help from the theoretical community to encourage the powers that be at ALMA to get this capability operating?
So I have not done the observations myself. I looked at some of the papers and I got very interested in this topic. But it seems to me that one issue is that if you have axisymmetric structures in your disk, you can have some polarization patterns that would mimic the presence of a magnetic field. And so it's difficult to disentangle the two. That's my understanding on that.
Is that
sketchy?
Yes.
That's from the scattering of aligned dust grains,
yes.
You mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
Scattering
of aligned dust grains that would magnetic fields would align dust grains, and that would give you a concern on magnetic fields. But other things, axisymmetric structures, can give rise to what look like aligned dust grains,
yes, exactly.
is what you're saying. But I'm asking a different question about Zeeman active molecules, which would have a circuit of polarization signature. And I know, I forget who she is, she was at the conference. Chemistry, she knows everything about chemistry, and I know that she's trying to...
Ilse
Cleaves, thank you for reminding me. Yeah, I know that she's trying to think about some particular types of molecules that could be used, but I thought in talking with her over dinner, Ilse, I know you can hear us, that ALMA itself was the issue, that it simply doesn't have that technical capability yet. It's currently being viewed as a low priority. Why else would you need circular polarization? What's the point? Is that, okay, so is that even worth writing? No.
So I think I heard her say that like in two seasons that they might have it.
Okay, I'm going to put it down. Or is that just crazy? I mean, I'm not a protoplanetary disk person, so please tell me if this is just completely crazy. But again, not being a protoplanetary disk person, looking at you all struggling to make MHD do something in these disks just makes me, I mean, skeptical of the whole paradigm. I mean, forgive me, right? And it's not MHD that's producing planets. It's these other things that are purely hydro in nature. Why do you all believe? That's why I said that you've all drunk the Kool-Aid. With very little evidence, as far as I can tell, that there's anything that MHD going on. Of course, not that there's any strong evidence that MHD is going on in any of these other systems either, except our own lives.
Homer, but even if we saw a signature of magnetic field, it yeah. wouldn't be clear whether the magnetic field was active or dead, right? How would we know?
If you're seeing magnetic structures, let me argue it this way. If you're seeing magnetic structures that are ordered on interesting length scales in a protoplanetary disk, I would say that Schwenning and Jake and these people who are doing these Hall MHD winds might be, at least, that's looking very promising.
Magnetic field strength. It doesn't tell you whether it's dynamically important. It only tells you that there is something that's large scale, and I'm countering this. Is this really telling us that the magnetic fields are driving the whole business?
No, that's true. But at least it would tell you that there might be an MHD. I mean, suppose it's related to the presence of winds from the inner disk. And actually, if we were actually able to get...
We know that there ought to be a magnetic field launching these winds and jet. You cannot get a jet in another way, so...
I agree.
Your community has persuaded the observers that that is the.
I should show you how jets are launched. I mean, sure, I'm very happy, but we know that there is a star in the middle or something, protostar, that probably has magnetic fields of its own. So my question is this the only place where the magnetic fields are present, or there are magnetic fields which are important in other places, like the disk itself, and they dynamically influence the disk behavior?
Well, what we know is that a large-scale magnetic field is a necessary, maybe not sufficient, but a necessary condition for a large-scale wind to be launched from the surface of a protoplanetary disk.
Do we?
Well, we know it's a necessary, but we don't know it's sufficient.
Excuse me, photoevaporative winds.
I'm just saying, not in the inner part of the disk, because you're inside the gravitational radius.
Right.
Okay. So if you have strong evidence of an outflow from the inner parts of the disk, not a jet right close to the star, not a wind at 30 AU, but something on scales of 1 AU or less, then there's very few other ways that you can think of, and I can't think of one other way, to actually get that material off the disk, such that it's got the escape velocity.
If it's going to be a significant contributor to accretion, then... The mass loss rate had better be
absolutely.
The same order of magnitude as the accretion rate that you need.
On the order of.
Yeah.
Within 10% or so.
Yeah. Within an order of magnitude.
Within an order of magnitude.
And so again, this really... but this looks like it's going to happen, that it's feasible and that it will happen. Okay.
So then, is the question settled that there are magnetic fields?
No. Because we don't have the measurements.
Star formation, I'm not sure if you remember that field, but like pretty clear there's important or at least visible, detectable magnetic fields like just a few 100,000 years before.
There's no question that the initial conditions are highly magnetized, and in fact the magnetic energy density is dominant, right, over the gas pressure. We know that. But try and get that magnetic field into the disk, and that's the question. That's the question across all these disciplines.
I mean, you could pose it the other way, right? How do you get the magnetic field out of the disk?
True.
Right? So I guess I'm saying, given that you can ask both questions sensibly, the idea that there should be some field in the disk doesn't seem...
Are you kidding? Who do you think you're talking to? I love MHD, okay? But what I really want to see, though, is... theoretically, we all have this very strong bias, but there is, as far as I can tell, absolutely zero observational evidence.
Some meteorite people who say that...
Who have remnant... There's remnant magnetism in those meteorites?
Yes.
At least in the solid nebula, there were fields of about the right strength to drive the accretion velocity.
But it could be an SRI dynamo.
Sorry, which kind of dynamo?
There could be a dynamo in the asteroid because they had been differentiated.
These are the ones where the fields on the different inclusions are misaligned with each other spatially. So they are thought to become from something that's pre-accretion.
I see Homer Green in there.
But then there's, we were discussing with Eric Blackmire an idea about the, actually using the solar wind. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that they can rule out that it was a dynamo in the asteroid?
It's argued that if it was a dynamo in the asteroid, then the inclusions would all have been accreted and held in the same orientation while they were picking up the magnetic field, so the field vectors ought to be aligned. Mm-hmm. And the one that they claim is a nebular field measurement, the magnetic field vectors are misaligned between different inclusions, which suggests that they were freely floating. The inclusions were freely floating when they were magnetized.
Also, the magnetization is along the short axis of these oblate spheroids, which is consistent with them being almost molten and rotating. So you preserve the short axis.
But then it goes back to the origin of chondrules.
Yeah, so the problem is that the problem with this is you get some very messy things about where do chondrules actually come from. But then also the issue of where they come from could be different from where they pick up their magnetization, as the Curie temperature and the solidus temperature, where they become solid, are actually different temperatures.
Right. I believe the splash model, which I'm not saying I do.
Should we not talk about chondral formation? Because I think that's
No,
I don't. What I would be interested in, is there a clear signature from the meteoritic data that the solar nebula was magnetized at the right level, such that these wind models and what have you would work?
Yes, if you assume that the chondrites were magnetized and accreted where we see them now in the asteroid belt.
Done.
Finished. Move on. You can remove the circle.
That assumption is highly questionable.
Yeah, well, it's if you assume a bunch of things, but so the question is, it becomes then an issue of if those are right assumptions.
Okay.
I'm reminded of I don't know what sort of sandwich Jean-Pierre represented a protoplanetary disk with. White dwarfs.
Can I linger a little bit on the left column?
Yeah.
What about Faraday rotation? Can we do anything with that at all?
Has anyone made estimates of that? No one's made estimates. Oh my gosh.
I know ALMA can do this for black holes, for sure. But maybe it's not sufficient to detect in this context.
Do you have enough electrons to produce significant rotation? That I don't know. That would be
This would be from the surface of very ionized.
If everything is within 0.1 to 1 AU is ionized, then that's where you would get it from, I guess.
But we already know that the surface is not very much ionized from some of the observations.
From 0.1 to 1?
That's a region we probe, we think. Maybe closer to 1. From the free emission, we see that it's not very much ionized.
So the disk is flared, and so you need to see something through that ionized material, right? So is the outer disk going to prevent you from doing that?
I'm still going to leave it up here. That's an interesting thing that may be worth thinking about. Actually, I'm going to add one other thing, and this was discussed briefly about, what are the commonalities in terms of variability that you all see in protoplanetary disks? Are they similar to what we see in the other sources in terms of power spectra, RMS flocks, log normal distributions, all of that stuff? The rest of us are curious about this, given that these are supposed to be universal features that we're seeing in other systems. Okay, should I put in the vanilla radiation MHD simulation with radiation?
Definitely.
Yes.
Radiation.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think there is a danger in putting everything in one, because that will discourage people who like one from doing it. They will be like, "Oh, what can we do?" So well, I suggest we add an asterisk saying if you can do less than what's requested, it's fine.
Well, but this is pretty minimal, I think. So that, and what we need so no binary title field or stream, no boundary layer.
Just a plain disk.
Yeah. So you're feeding it axisymmetrically. With some magnetic fields, and
then there will be a question of, does the result depend on how you feed it, because it's so close?
Right.
So for me, it's nicer if you feed it, like if you put a big disk, then the longer you run it, the further out the turbulence will go, but at least the inner part of the disk, if the disk is large enough, will be essentially in steady state. So why do you want to feed it?
So let me get at that. So I had a very dip. I'm being recorded. I'll just say it. Yanfei was there. So I was complaining to my former student Shane Davis about the fact that, you know, we've been talking about these RMS flux relations and everything. You've got global radiation MHD simulations. Yes, they haven't established a steady state way out, but surely the inner disk has reached a steady state. Come on, why haven't you guys looked for the RMS flux relation? Why haven't you done that? And Shane, with a little bit of, with an irate tone of voice, said, I told you, Omer, we have, and we didn't see it. Okay, and I am being recorded, but Shane, this emotionally scarred me as his former PhD advisor, so I think it's burned into my memory, so I think I'm reporting it accurately. So, you know, this is not a trivial question. Yes.
It's not going to work like that, because if you, there's no binary type of field, what you do with the angular momentum? If there's no stream,
you have to have a source of that, yeah, you do.
A source and a sink, so.
Yeah, so we should put some sort of tor on it, and it could be an axisymmetric torque that we're just exerting on the disk. Right.
But a disk like a gas reservoir, which would be
and source.
But so I'm trying
source,
to.
Not really empty the disk.
But how is it different from a big disk? Big disk with the big angular momentum. Large disk, yes. Like the usual initial condition, like we do, but to make it big, okay?
But we want much more detail than you provide up to now. It's like profile, okay? So,
but again, how is it different?
We need some.
But how is it different than what? Because here you are suggesting to feed it and fix it symmetrically by hand, and I'm saying I'm worried whenever I touch something by hand that it will prevent the angular momentum from propagating out or something like this. So wouldn't it be safer to just put a big disk?
Sasha, what we want is a stationary disk. How you do it is your problem.
We already have those.
Well, I should have better than that.
No.
I don't insist, but if you want to have something that looks from far away like a Nova like this.
Well, Sasha, you should run a software which calculates all of these various observable quantities to see whether or not your disk matches.
Yeah, I mean, look, we just have vanilla MHD, no radiation, but, you know, magnetic fields, momentum transport.
You've got a dynamo cycle.
Dynamo.
One of the apparently possible drivers of variability. Question is, you know, when you take a global simulation, what you have is a whole, like Tony was saying, a whole load of shearing boxes glued together. Is there a particular radius where the dynamo cycle timescale controls what you see in terms of the variability, or what you see, is it just as an interesting superposition? If so, what is the weighting that you give to each part of the disk in terms of how it drives what's seen by the central star when the final bit of accretion takes place?
Right.
Is that known from existing global simulations?
It's beginning to be known, again, from the work of Hogg and Reynolds. Again, they're using proxies.
Yeah.
But, I mean those, I'm not, so I don't mean to be critical
how,
of those proxies.
How big does the disk need to be such that the variability no longer cares?
Yeah. And that would then be you've reached.
And then you've reached the position where you don't care anymore about the size of the disk.
And no cheating. H over R much less than one.
What do you want?
Much better than what? Look.
What do you want?
Look better than what? Much better.
0.001? 10 to the minus 2.
Is 1% enough? 2%?
1%, 2%.
5%?
I'm afraid of this construction.
5%?
No, up to 5%.
5%. You heard him, and he's been recorded.
Well, I think the crux statement really, what is the equation really you want? Because, for example, if you have like a strong radiation pressure or magnetic pressure, the scale height may not be the same as you will guess based on optics model. So I would say the only thing you want really, what is the equation really you want? Like for white dwarf, 10⁻⁹ almost per year is enough? Or you want 10⁻⁩, or do you want 10⁻⁺, for example? I think that is more meaningful quantity for me.
If it is a novel like Gaia, then this is the scale height. Okay, it's not this, it's not the height of others. The scale height is less than 5%.
Yeah, I know. Oh, so if you
have enough, then it will be a good approximation. Medium approximation, but it won't be the novel like this if it is more than 5%. That's why I mentioned, because I know it's extremely difficult.
I think what Yanfei is saying is that he will get the thickness automatically if you tell him what the mass supply rate is.
Not so much for the novel like that. If you want to get afterwards dwarf novel outburst, then you must have this variance in this, because because this has to do with of the sounds. If not, you will never get global out of the sounds. So.
But that's not necessary to get at this stuff.
Yeah, here is.
So I would say maybe that's two. Get down to those levels, and then maybe even trip the thermal instability, trip the ionization instability. If we can just trip it and get us up front to start propagating, I would be enormously happy.
Yeah, sure.
It'll be a long time before we can follow a whole cycle.
And you know what might happen, I thought about it, just obvious, that this might not be axisymmetric, contrary to the usual assumption.
Where's Chris? It might not even be even parity.
No, this is not just a bit.
With respect to midplane either.
It would be in the form of a spiral.
Yeah.
Front.
Yes.
This is going to be something, because we assume it's axisymmetric, right, because we are in one dimension. But.
Right. So, but again, you want an axisymmetric background in order not to have tidal fields generating spiral structures or anything like that, right?
This is not going to be very interesting. This is just a test bed for the code, because.
Okay, we have to have a volunteer to do such a simulation. At least one volunteer. But you're all really demanding this.
It's a very good PhD subject for a bad student. Or a student you want to punish.
This is being recorded, so now you have just killed any possibility of getting any student to work on that.
It was not my idea to put it. It's me, but I'm not so much.
You have just set the field back.
For one, what kind of dynamic range and radius do we want as well? Do we want the 100? Do we want 20?
I would start with 10. Start simple and build your way out. And you know, we could even do what Richard suggests, not do the whole rate, because radiation is the limiting factor here. Or is it? Maybe it's just the viscous time that's the limiting factor. It's not even the radiation solver.
What overhead do you have to pay to get radiation in your simulations?
Well, if you want to do four angular dependent radiation transfer, it almost rather this effect of 4 to 5 more expensive. Right.
So what Phil was saying about the trade-off really does come into play.
If you want to really get the correct scale height, well, we know some dynamics matter for a lot of ways. Well, for example, do you just want to use the cooling function to control your scale height? Yeah. Or we also know, like, the vertical structure of this was quite different in isothermal simulations and adiabatic simulations. Mm-hmm. How do you know
like, okay, if you just run isothermal simulation.
I certainly wouldn't advocate isothermal, but...
Again, was it really set up to think
that? What about short characteristics? What about a method of short characteristics? We don't have to do full angular dependence if these are very optically thick.
Well, if you just want to use a short characteristic, I think no one has actually used that to couple the full dynamics, particularly if you want to open thick regimes. So you can use that to estimate the cooling. You can also use that to calculate the L tensor and couple with the implicit mission solver. But that is also not that cheap.
Yeah, just solving the time-dependent transfer equation looks pretty straightforward, according to what you're you've been telling me.
Yeah, so we still have some we still have some questions about convergence issues here.
So this is still the, do we think, it's
possible that external large scale magnetic fields that are present in global calculations or perhaps some equivalent radiation, which is something like an effective Prandtl number, improves that situation.
Right.
That's an optimistic view of things, that adding more physics makes it easier.
Yeah, but I think it's I think
what do we really know about that, those
We don't yet, and it's going to be a lot of work. We know that there's a large segment of our community, of the theoretical community, that is obsessed about those issues, and they will continue to pound away at us. And the rest of us will just be. I'm not saying that needs to be done. It's absolutely essential. We're deluding ourselves if we're pretend. But if my viewpoint though is if we all focus on this, I mean it's an important problem that many of us need to focus on it, but if we all focus on this, we will never, ever make contact with observations. Ever. So I am really hoping that observations can also help, constrain us a little bit. Even if our simulations aren't fully converged. That's my optimistic viewpoint, but it is an optimistic viewpoint. Is that fair? Does anyone want to argue with me about that?
I guess I would just point out that in local calculations, actually the thing that is hardest to obtain convergence on appears to be the variability properties. Mm. And so there's reason.
Even though the butterfly diagram seems to be ubiquitous?
So that part is obviously very well converged, but other aspects, such as the RMS variability, are known to depend on domain size. So,
right, the level of RMS variability, that's true. But things like the RMS flux relation, I mean,
there's many things there. I certainly haven't checked them all, but certainly.
Yeah, I agree.
Come on.
He wants to move on. Oh, come on. I'm going to just say it. People need to be pushing on timing missions, X-ray timing. That is a domain that still needs to be pursued by the observational community, and many of us would like to support that in any way we can. I know many of us. So that's on the observational side, and some of us are still hoping that AstroSat will have interesting things to say here. Yuri and Alexandra, or Phil, what would you like to see theorists do in the area of X-ray binaries? Before you answer, I still think the thin to thick. Disk transition is a really interesting thing to be pursuing.
What about the slow motion stability?
Yeah. I was going to say about the transitions, and the problem there is we still need to do a huge amount of work on the observational side across all wavelengths.
Even the reverse one is also, it's not clear what happens there.
No. You mean the soft to hard?
Yeah.
So hard to soft also.
Direction of the meters field.
I mean, all the
millimeters here, X-ray pulsars, millisecond pulsars, ULX pulsars, all this.
Okay.
Which is just with the
stellar. Oh, God. Okay. And that would be of interest to the protoplanetary disk community, too, right? Okay, I'll put it in. I will be surprised if anyone takes you up on that, though. But stellar magnetosphere.
What do you mean takes you up on those?
Okay, Sasha, you've just volunteered.
He does this.
He does it already.
You missed it.
You missed his talk.
That's true.
He presented his own
story. I missed it. So I'm sorry. Okay, great. And
Kyle Parfrey is leading this effort.
Excellent.
It's going very well.
Okay, excellent. Oh, fantastic. Okay. See, you. Great. I haven't viewed your talk yet.
It's a problem for this tree.
Yes.
That's nothing special.
Yes. That's why I like black hole accretion.
But here, you can actually have the period of the star telling you about some interesting interactions which might have nothing to do with the disk itself, or they might.
Right.
So there is another extra observable, at least one observable.
Right. And the data is actually rich. There's a lot of interesting data to compare with. I'm sorry.
As a long-term observable thing is that you find the connection between the transfer rate, accretion rate, and the duty cycle. That would be super. But I don't know when you're going to do that.
There you have an addition to X-ray timing, you will have hopefully X-ray polarimeter soon. So and then for the
do we believe this? Those of us who are gray.
Space now acceptable.
It's
2020 and the
2020.
Oh, we could see lots of things. So the X-ray polarimetry over what band?
It's an acceptable standard X-ray band. It's on the now accepted. So it will be 2020 end of 2020.
Up to the Compton hump?
No.
Oh, of course not. Of course not.
It's up between 2 and 10 something.
Yeah. Still, there should be a signature. It's all Compton scattering.
No,
there,
but I'm talking about the third, because once we have a pulsar, you will have immediate geometry.
Oh, yeah. No, there. Yeah, no, right, okay.
You'll have all the angles now.
And there's already been a lot of theoretical work.
Because for many black hole binaries, it's very difficult to measure, like explanations.
It'll still be useful even in black hole location systems. That's right. But in this, it'll be incredibly interesting. Why it's taken the X-ray community to, because they don't like killing the number of photons, usable photons. I think that's the main answer. Yes. I thought you wanted to say something.
I think there's a common subject for the three, the fourth. It has been solved by Sasha, but still it's probably worth of improving the relation between disk and jet.
Hasn't been solved by Sasha. Has been touched on by Sasha.
I said it has been solved, but it can be still improved.
And Jean-Pierre, don't you feel that certainly in the X-ray binary, the big unknown is the geometry of the mechanism by which the disk is being irradiated?
I wanted to say that, but I was afraid that we tried to be a bore. I'm good that you said that. Radiation, we don't know how disks are irradiated.
What would you, it's easy to pose questions. This is an agenda for, what are we going to do to tackle that problem?
I don't know.
Observationally, theoretically what?
I'm worried that the only thing you're putting down you can calculate is where you've taken out all the interesting things that make the disk behave in ways that we see.
Dante's doing that now.
Why not the cosmological constant?
So Phil, Charles, this is really is being pursued right now.
Okay.
The thing is, you know, it turns out that such simulations are revealing all sorts of crazy behavior on the way to reaching a steady state, and it may be because we put everything in, but and so the question is, are we going to get anything useful to compare with observations, or should we have the simpler calculation first? But no, this is becoming feasible, really.
I just suggest that yes. Hercules X1 and similar systems with regards to disk warping. I don't know how common that type of system is, but we know of at least one where a processing disk model seems to work quite well.
Yeah.
There are more than that.
Right, okay. So there's a...
Can I ask all of you, so as we go across these sources, where do we have evidence of disk warps? So I know they exist on large scales in AGM, maser disks. They certainly exist. There are processing disks in X-ray binaries.
And we see them. R is super small.
We see them.
Yeah, negative superhumps.
Is this for superhumps?
Negative superhumps. Okay, great. And I heard rumors that
processing jets. Images of misaligned binaries with disks.
But they're not
image to
warp them.
KH15D, no,
though. KH15D, there's been some discussion of there being a warp, and then there's there's at least two cases now where there's some circumstantial evidence for a misaligned inner and outer disk based on radiative transfer calculations of shadowing in outer disks. Whether or not that's a warp or not, I don't know, and whether or not it's actually there or it's just an artifact from radiative transfer calculations.
Interesting. So, Chris, what are you going to do to tackle that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, a place where I think there may be some more gain to be made, perhaps in B star X-ray binaries, where you have observational evidence of warps and eccentric motion for the disk. we have simulations now that produce very similar structures and produce different types of X-ray outbursts, at least in the accretion rates onto the neutron star. So I certainly hope that this is what with Rebecca Martin.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily mean, I'm not sure that I've interpreted what you're saying correctly, but what struck me about this is that, forget about the neutron star companion, that is, so I don't mean X-ray binary, I mean BE decretion disk simulations. That aspect of it, I think is an interesting and accessible problem. Again, gosh knows how the magnetic field geometry affects all of this.
But there's not many fields in BE shots. Your global magnetic.
Right. You don't need global magnetic fields to launch an MRI, right? You just need.
No, I understand. I'm just saying that all the stuff you've been talking about with global ordered fields, you're not observed at all in BE stars.
Right. Right. But that in a sense makes these even more ideal for many of us because.
You're preaching to the guy who's been preaching.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I've been preaching this for many years. Working group BE star guy to try to get people interested in BE stars because they're great laboratories for disk physics.
Yeah, so this, in my view, is maybe as simple as this.
Yeah.
Very narrow radial ranges.
And it's not ordered magnetic field, forget about that. It's just MRI and let it rip.
Yeah, they interstellar radii before they become optically thin at H alpha. And they're rotating very close to critical. You just dump material in near the star and it diffuses outward instead of outward in. So it's just like turning the disk upside down and everything backwards, but all the disk physics of transport is there, and they vary on time scales.
On human time scales.
Time scales where you can watch things, like little experiments are going on all the time, right in front of your eyes.
So when you said it's more of the magnetic field, this is the field
related to the disk, or it's...
So there are 10% of massive stars that have been observed to have large-scale magnetic fields through spectral colorimetry. Mm-hmm. And the only exception going all the way from O to B to A is the beaten stars. There's not a single one has been detected by spectral polarimetry to have large-scale fields. Okay. And the reason, I think, is simple. When you have an accretion disk, you can basically have the field dominate near the star, and then the material outer disk is basically non-magnetic until it gets close to the star, and then you have this fight between what happens, you know, the stellar magnetospheric disk interaction number three there. But in decretion disk, the actual creation of the disk requires that the material be able to get into Kepler in orbit. And it can't happen with decretion because the magnetic field will just disrupt the disk before it gets a chance to form. And we've done simulations of this process, Asa Vadula, and you just never make it. You never make a disk when you have any field at all there.
Yeah, right.
So, Emma, this wasn't quite the point I was.
No, but I immediately reinterpreted it. But go ahead, now reiterate your point.
With the neutron star companion,
yeah,
the star X-ray binders, you get various different types of X-ray emission. As I understand it, you have a low-level background emission, then you have periodic, roughly on the orbital period of the binary, type 1 outbursts, which are 10th Bennington or so, and then you get type 2 outbursts that happen every 20 to 30 orbits.
Not to be confused with type 1 and type 2 in the standard X-ray, neutron star X-ray binary.
Correct. Nothing to do.
Okay.
Don't get confused.
Okay.
Yes. Bad phenomenology aside. Rebecca Martin led a couple of papers in 2014 where I think convincingly showed that a good explanation for this is essentially the neutron star is grabbing material every orbit at pericenter, but then the disk can go through a Kozai-Lidov cycle where the whole disk behaves as a global Kozai cycle. Mm-hmm. And it's when the disk eccentricity is at its maximal that you can get a large outburst, and that generates the type 2. And so those sorts of simulations have been done with hydro plus an alpha, but...
Presumably once you start this research program, one could then start adding in the field of a companion star or an orbiting companion star and doing interesting things. I'm sorry, Stan.
I just wanted to ask. So the feeding of the neutron star is coming through the BE disk diffusion material, right?
Yep.
Okay, and of course that can excite all kinds of modes in the diffusion disk, which you see in the observations, the H alpha variations.
Is this fair, Chris, an eccentric?
Yes, you need both the disk eccentricity and the
neutron star.
Is the model here that the orbital plane is misaligned with respect to the spin axis of the B star?
Yeah.
So that's where you get your lateral misalignment from. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's being pursued within alpha disk and SPH and hydro right now. But I see.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Okay, and now that I've erased the final topic, okay, I feel I have to, although I'm not going to do a mea culpa, I refuse to do a mea culpa, I still think that there is an interesting thing here, and that's the theorists need to understand, and that's baroclinicity in PRAD, barometric P-gas simulation. A few of you know what I'm talking about, but
not many.
Some of us don't.
When you're hugely radiation pressure supported, as you are in luminous AGN accretion disks, you talk about density fluctuations that you see in strongly magnetized simulations. It's easy, really easy, to get strong density fluctuations in this case because MRI turbulence is supersonic with respect to the gas sound speed. Just on its own, okay? Because your radiation pressure supported, it's still subsonic turbulence. And therefore, on scales in which photons can diffuse on the same time scale as you're compressing the gas, or want to compress the gas becomes enormously compressible because radiation pressure can't respond to push gas out of the way. And so you get enormous density fluctuations. The temperature distribution is fairly uniform. And that means, and remember, radiation pressure is driven by temperature because it's AT, a third AT to the fourth. That means radiation pressure and density are no longer really coupled together. And so their gradient vectors can be in completely different directions. And that is baryclinicity. And baryclinicity, I gather, is a great source of all sorts of interesting fun and games in hydro, in hydrodynamics. And that physics exists in spades in this regime. That's the one thing that's still one of the many. There are many things that intrigue me about AGM, but that is one thing that really intrigues me about that regime of accretion that we still, as theorists, really need to probe and understand.
Happens in massless stars too.
It happens in any regime where you're well. Here, when you have turbulence, so but it, yeah.
But the kind of stuff that Yonkei did in massless star domain.
Yes, when you have convection or
close to the Eddington limit and such.
Right. Right.
But yeah, so then you get large density fluctuations, and then the medium becomes porous.
Yes.
And porosity then becomes a dominant factor in how you do your radiation transport.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right, which which again, Yonfei knows all about. And that brings us finally to the bugaboo in both of these regimes, is how the heck does the standard radiation pressure-dominated thermal instability work or not work, and what is it doing? What role is it playing in these two regimes?
Well, for AGM, another interesting is how important is the subgravity? Or if you have subgravity, make a disk fragment, what kind of star you have?
And that's relevant to this to this regime in some stages as well, right?
So while you write the solvent for AGMs, you have your Lexus and extra binaries, and you have extra pulsars.
Yes, yes, yes. It's just that AGN have the, I mean, well, extra pulsars, yeah, okay.
So you Lexus with black holes.
Your Lexus with black holes,
your
Lexus with pulsars.
All of them are I'm happy to erase the acronym AGN. So physics. And then I could add self-gravity as well. And the particular self-gravity and its interaction with this sort of thing, which then rules out protoplanetary disks, and that's a different area.
What about disk sizes in AGN? It has been discussed here. But
it has been. I mean, the micro lensing and reverberation mapping.
The complete threshold solution for that, or was the observation
misinterpreted?
I mean, so you know, Dexter and Agle had a.
That's one possibility.
Not a possible explanation of that, but there's also a question perhaps about the interpretation of the observations.
Yeah, I think there are. Yes, there's that
if
as well.
If the observation is interpreted as it is commonly interpreted, that's a very zero-order disagreement with.
With a model that we know cannot be true anyway. I mean, where are you? Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to get emotional again, just as I did with you, sir, and I don't mean anything. Okay, having lived with a colleague of mine for the last 23 years, I am well aware that the standard model is a, you know, how many darts do you need to throw at it? How long do you need to flog this dead horse to kill this dead horse? It's dead. It's really dead. The Shakura-Sinyai model is in and of itself inconsistent when you're in this regime. It's thermally unstable, okay? So that, you know, we've been, even theoretically, it's not a good regime. You're comparing it with the standard disk model, but we know the standard disk model isn't, A, it's not theoretically inconsistent, and B, we knew that it wasn't working in AGN anyway. It doesn't produce the right spectral energy distributions of any shape or form. It's just.
So, Omer, why does it produce a reasonable shape and form in X-ray binaries?
Because I think, in my view, radiation pressure is more important in AGN. This extra piece of physics that we're still not quite understanding is much more important in AGN than it is in X-ray binaries. And by X-ray binaries, I mean. So the high soft state and the very high state of black hole X-ray binaries. I'm not talking about ULXs and things like that. Yeah. Sorry.
So what scale is half-life radius?
It's a factor of three typically, and you get this from reverberation.
I mean, the number of short shy radii. I don't remember what the figure is.
Depends on the mass and the radii you're talking about.
Yeah.
But typically 10 to 8 thermos per coil. With a mass accretion radii 20%. For the optical G band, for example, GRIZ band,
typically go to like a 20 to 40 shop units.
By the way, that reminds me of another thing that in the X-ray binary context, I do think it's worthwhile trying to, I mean, a few people have done this. They weren't represented in our program, so it's something that we really didn't discuss much. But I do think it's worthwhile trying to incorporate radiation pressure-driven mass laws or something like that into the dwarf nova machinery, the dim machinery, to try and model the light curves of crazy sources like GRS 1915 plus 105, to try and get at that. It's not an MHD simulation, but to try and get at the physics of what's driving this crazy variability. And I think that's an important problem. How do you explain the heartbeat state, for example?
For AGNs, another interesting is the Lagrangian wind.
Yeah. Oh, and right. And I promised that we would talk a lot about outflows, and we haven't even. And we didn't get there.
Because you're really AGNs, it should be AGNs.
And the cookies are eaten. AGN plus physics.
But really, what we should be talking about is outflows all across the spectrum, driven by a variety of mechanisms: photoevaporation, thermally driven winds, radiation pressure, hydro physics, and MHD winds.
It's a change of vector physics.
Yes.
Oh, and one of the phenomena you get in AGNs is you get this strange line walking. Indicates that it's only a few lines that are actually
dominating.
And you see that also in
SS-433, famously. Is that still thought to be the explanation?
No.
No. Does anyone know what the explanation is?
It's not the line locking of Lyman alpha the continuum.
I don't think so.
I don't think it is anymore, no.
Yeah. Look at that for a while.
I don't think so. Explanation.
It's a shame. It was so
beautiful. So I'd like to hear anybody that knows more about that. Let me know.
Does SS-433 count as a massive star in some way, shape, or form? It's anywhere?
Ed Rendelhoyle was in here. He gave a nice talk about it at the STARS session.
Right. We did, yeah, that was...
Oh, I missed that then, so that's something to look at then. Okay, did he talk about the 0.26C though? Or?
No, well, he didn't mention it that much in his talk, but he and I have talked about it. We should maybe break into a group. If you want to talk about line driving and line walking, it would be good to get a group of people.
Yeah.
Like Ed and other people who might be interested in that.
Yeah, okay. Well, for those of you who are sticking around beyond this week, or who are coming back, but then the STARS people won't be here. But I will still be here, Stan. Yeah. And Jan Fay will still be here. And Matt will still be here. And Greg will still be here. We're loving it.
Maybe not. Maybe by the number, Jan Fay will go somewhere.
I hope you will go. I hope you will go. I really hope.
Oh. Okay, remember we're being recorded.
I have no idea. I have no internal information, but I really hope that.
So it's interesting to me as an outsider.
Yes, please.
I mean, yes, things with neutron stars, black holes, and white dwarfs are really exciting things. But before you get to that state, we go to a more boring state where one star feeds another star. And we're definitely not in the left regime, I think. So typically we have one O star feeding maybe an early B-type star. 7 out of 10 massive stars go through that phase. Maybe it's not exciting enough to spend all your CPU power on computing those things, but there's big open questions there for us where I would hope to get some of the people here interested.
Are you talking about the infamous common envelope phase?
No. Stable mass transfer.
Okay, just simple
Boring
mass
angle
transfer.
System. I know okay. This sounds like last century discussions, but all these systems go through that, right? So one of the big problems we think about on the stellar physics side, and we need some input from the accretion disk side, is
yes.
How much angular momentum is going from the disk into the star. If you just accrete from the inner orbit of the accretion disk, that star is going to spin up and break up within no time. And then what happens? How does a star spinning at break up feed back to its disk? So we have a sort of a BE star situation, only now the mass is fed from the outside. right? I mean, this is one of the biggest uncertainties for us when we predict how many black holes you form, any kind of products from stellar physics. So that's, I'm interested, it's not on this list. I know it's more boring than X-ray binaries, but it's
algol systems.
Algol is, yeah, I guess that's the name.
Or symbiotics, is
semi-detached systems.
Or, I'm sorry?
Not semi-biotics, that is a subset, but semi-detached binaries.
Semi-detached.
One filling its Roche slope and the other one being a regular.
Okay, so that's actually putting the stars on the computational domain as well. So none of these simulations being proposed here are doing that except for the primaries.
It's a boundary condition for you.
Is this a boundary problem?
Yeah, okay. I'll put it up here.
I was going to give my shot with Jan Pai, but he seems pretty busy if I look at this.
He needs students. And he needs students who are not going to be told that this is a waste of time and they'll never get tired of paper
suits.
You
can include it in terms of a different inner boundary condition, some of the effects.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's just, we have a feeding rate like similar to BE star, but we have also feeding from the outside.
Oh, I see. So we could construct an experiment where we're feeding from the inside and from the outside, is the idea? And there's a narrow range in radii. What's the numerical simulation that you'd like to see?
Once you feed the material into the star and speed it up to critical, then you can't get more stuff out of the star. It basically gets ejected as fast as you put it out. So it's basically stuck there. It can't really accrete anymore. So it backs up. It's almost like a bathtub that's backed up.
Right.
And so what happens to that? That disk. It's kind of a disk that's sitting there that can't go either way. It can't accrete and it can't decrete.
But as soon as it can transfer the angular momentum, you can accrete.
Yeah, you do, because you need that to do the angular momentum transport. Well, you're saying it's all tidal. It's completely tidal, is that?
Will there be any waves? Because, might be a.
Between the disk and the star and the orbit, but.
So might I suggest, thank you for that, I suspect the refreshments are ready. I think you piqued the interest of a bunch of people. Will you be having coffee and tea? Let's talk about that.